Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to the Weekly Critic podcast. I am Ben Sixsmith, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Patrick Galbraith. Patrick is a columnist for The Critic. He writes our Country Notes column, and he's also the author of the book In Search of One Last Song. Patrick, how are you today?
I'm really well, thank you. I'm quite, a couple of nights ago, I got woken up in the middle of the night by my spaniel puppy, who had been sick all over my hallway after I'd given her some defrosted muntjac deer the night before. And I feel like I'm still the sort of residual tiredness from that. It really kind of takes it out of you emotionally, cleaning up dog sick from all over the walls. So, but other than that, I'm very well.
I guess at least the next time you have muntjac deer, you'll know that you're not obliged to give her any. You know, you can enjoy it all.
Well, I've
by
got
yourself.
A freezer full of muntjac deer, and I was thinking about having some actually today. And you know what? Like, the smell of regurgitated muntjac deer, it puts you off muntjac deer for a little bit. But I think her muntjac deer eating days, maybe we're going to put a pause on that for a bit, I think.
Maybe in the future when her stomach has reached full strength. But I will understand if you don't wish to experiment too much
with that again. Yeah.
As you might have guessed from the title of Patrick's column, you do write about nature. Would you call yourself a nature writer, or would you not want to kind of categorize yourself? So
I thought you were going to say, would you call yourself a naturist? Yeah. Do I write about nature? Yeah, I would say probably not, actually. Probably not. I had a interesting conversation the other day with, let's just call him Britain's foremost nature writer. And he said to me that he's been trying for a long time to get past the tag of nature writer. Mm. And I said to him, well, it's really very easy. You've just got to write about things like fox hunting and those guys will drop you pretty quickly. And he smiled and we parted ways. But no, I think, you know, I'm interested in sort of the people at the coalface, the people who are really, you know, so conservationists and gamekeepers and deer stalkers and sort of all the tensions surrounding that. You know, I don't really know what nature writing means, but I think a lot of it is there's lots of stuff on finding yourself in the countryside and leaving London and starting an allotment and all of that kind of thing. And that's not really where I'm at.
What brought you to your subject? I mean, when you write about politics, as I do, it's just, you know, everyone's on Twitter, everybody's watching the news. It's kind of a natural thing. So what inspired you to write about these?
Well, I think to start with, it's enjoying these things. You know, I like being out stalking deer at 5 a.m, as I was last week, and that's how the muntjac deer came to be in my dog's dog bowl. But I'm particularly interested, I think, in sort of tensions in the countryside at the moment and kind of, you know, lost ways of living. I mean, In Search of One Last Song is very much about going to talk to people who live alongside the birds that book concerns itself with. So it's sort of, I'm sure there are a few bird watchers who were slightly disappointed in that book because it's not really about birds. It's about how Britain is changing, seen through the lens of birds and seen through our relationship with birds. And that's kind of what I'm interested in. I'm interested in sort of like Britain's rural soul. And, you know, I think Britain's soul is actually quite sort of, you know, green. I think we're very interested in the countryside in this country, and that relationship tells quite a lot. So you know, that's kind of, but I was laughing about naturism. I find myself, I'm interested in sort of subcultures as well. Mm. And I remember a little while ago, I wrote a piece, I think it was for The Critic, actually. I wrote about it in a few different places, but I went to stay with some naturists just outside Hull. And I sort of laughed to myself as I left this naturist community and said, that's definitely the last time that I'm going to do anything like that. And a couple of weeks ago, I was in the woods in Kent with the British Naturist Ramblers Society. You find yourself drawn back to these kind of oddities and, you know, drawn back to these things. And it's a funny thing as a journalist, you think, God, like, here we go again. That's actually an interesting sort of thing in the countryside. I think you have these subcultures that emerge and these ways of being. And these kind of utopian like visions of how we could exist. So to me, it's messy, it's all tied up into a kind of messy hole.
Hull seems like an eccentric place for a naturist society. I can't quite imagine Philip Larkin cycling along on his bicycle and running into one of their annual meetings.
What I love is that everybody in Hull has a Philip Larkin story. So, you know, so I was in Hull not long before I was with the naturists, or maybe not long after, it was a couple of years ago now, I forget. And I was there with the Humber Wildfowlers. And there was an old guy there, and we were standing there, and the sort of sun was coming up over the Humber Bridge, and we were trying to shoot ducks. And I said to him, "Oh, you know, Philip Larkin." I said, "You've been around in Hull for a long time. You must have seen Philip Larkin wandering around." And he said, "Seen him." He said, "I fixed his lawnmower actually." And there was this pause, and then he goes, "Actually, I fixed his lawnmower twice." So like everybody has these kind of. You know, I'm sure there are lots of men in Hull, lots of old guys who claim to have fixed Philip Larkin's lawnmower, but yeah, it's an odd thing.
And of course, Philip Larkin wrote a beautiful poem about killing a hedgehog with his lawnmower. So perhaps that man was digging out
was telling the truth.
The carcass of the hedgehog.
I did actually wonder that. I'm not sure. Who knows? I'll probably end up back there. I would imagine at some point shooting ducks again.
Are you someone who, do you spend most of your life in the countryside, or do you prefer to kind of spend some time in city life and some time in rural?
I spend a lot of my time in the city, really. I like being in Camberwell. What I like more than anything with Camberwell in South London, which is where I am at the moment, I love people. So I used to live in Dumfries and Galloway, which is southwest Scotland, very remote. There aren't many people around, and I loved so much of it, but I didn't like the fact there weren't many people around, because that's what I really like. So I sort of love the countryside. I love rural issues, but I also love people. And actually, you know, I think in this country, we're very into this notion of like, are you a person of the town or a person of the country? And like, I'll look out my window here and I see there's these Polish guys who live down the road, and they walk to the ponds in Burgess Park to go fishing with their cans. So like, you know, is that an urban pursuit or is that a rural pursuit? I met an old guy the other day, an old Chinese guy who was poaching eels in the Thames, and like, again, you have that, you know what I mean? So I think it's really interesting. And also, if I go to the local pub here, there'll be guys reading the Racing Post. People want to talk to you about lurchers. People love to want dogs, you know. So it's like, so it's kind of interesting. I think that whole idea of a great split is a relatively new thing. And obviously in the countryside you have fewer and fewer people. I mean, there are places where you have more and more people, but the people you have are often like advertising execs who live in Hoxton during the week or whatever. So for me, there's a kind of complicated thing going on there.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, there is, to some extent, a misanthropic strain in writing about nature. I mean, one of my favorite books is J.A. Baker's The Peregrine, but I'd like to meet him.
Yeah.
But it's a good point that we shouldn't draw like a clear divide between city folk and country folk, or else we're not going to have any kind of conversation going on. Because
no, it's a weird thing, and I don't know, it's sort of odd. It's odd where it comes from. I don't know whether there's something to do with kind of nature writers of the 30s and 40s looking at the countryside as this kind of pure place and a pure sort of point of difference, maybe. I think there's probably a bit of that going on. I mean, I think there's also a lot of there's a real lack of trust between rural England and the city. I mean, I went down the other day and spoke to a farmer in Devon about various issues going on with land access. And he was a young guy, this guy. His dad was really the farmer. He was kind of, you know, and I said to him, "What do you think of the whole land access thing?" And he said, "I wish that those rich folk in London would just stop fucking telling us what to do." Mm. You know, and that's like sort of, it's very simple, but that captures a whole lot of the kind of feeling between. So there's that as well, I think. Which is really, really interesting. I've got a friend, a lady called Katrina Porteous, who's a very good poet, who I went to speak to for my first book. She lives on the coast of Northumberland. And I think she's interested in the same things as me, actually. But she went around during Foot and Mouth and just asked people what they thought about it. And that was really interesting. And that sort of shows that great division and a lack of understanding in an interesting way.
Yeah, it's a real virtue of your columns for the magazine that you do include lots of conversations with people who generally would not get a voice in any publication, but maybe especially a publication like The Critic. There's a quote in one of your recent pieces. You're talking to a gamekeeper and he says, educated people and policymakers don't tend to listen to the likes of him. I mean, you're quoting him there rather than agreeing with him, but do you think that's true?
I can't remember the piece exactly, but yeah, I think that is true. I mean, I know exactly who that was. I was actually having some beers with him at the weekend. But yeah, I mean, I think that is very much true. When it comes to rural issues, it's often like you're sort of Oxbridge grads in nice walking boots on one side who feel that they're battling it out with kind of other Oxbridge grad hedge fund boys on the other side. And you just get these guys in the middle who are like completely fucking, you know, overlooked, forgotten about, dismissed. I think it's a really interesting thing. I saw the other day, I was somewhere and there was an argument going on between a father who had some children with him, actually quite a kind of articulate guy. And he was shouting at some employees of a landowner. And he said, you know, I hope he pays you well. And there was so much in that that he just saw these guys as kind of lackeys of this like landowner who embodies everything that he's against kind of thing. And it's just really like, it's really the extent to which we manage to project things onto the countryside is really fascinating. You know, rather than listening.
Yeah, it's an almost feudal sentiment, the idea that if you're working in the countryside, you must be a kind of peasant who's just toiling.
Yeah. And, you know, and I, you know, I know guys running conservation businesses and so on and whatever who do very, very well, you know, farm advisory. So, you know, it's a much more complicated place, I think, than lots of people would like to imagine. So, which is why it's so interesting.
A lot of your pieces are about hunting, which is such an emotive issue. I mean, I am a vegetarian. I don't eat meat. But I find that people who I know will tuck into a Big Mac are vehemently against hunting. If you were talking to someone who was like, I don't get it. Like, I don't understand the appeal. Why do people do this? How would you articulate what you find?
I suppose I could tell them, you know, why I enjoy it. I think it's such a sort of rich engagement with nature. You know, if you're fishing, for example, it's like you're standing there on a riverbank. If you're like fishing with a fly or whatever, even fishing with worms, and you're trying to imagine like life beneath the surface, you know, and so it gives you a kind of way of, you know, everyone likes to quote John Berger all the time. I'm very bored of that, but you know, it does give you like a way of seeing. You know, the same with, you know, if you said to me, oh, I want to shoot ducks in October, I said, okay, well, you know, what's the weather going to be like? What's the moon doing? You know what I mean? So that's really interesting. And I think it's sort of paradoxical, but it gives you a tremendous love of nature and of animals. You know, there's nothing that gives you a greater sense of an animal's kind of superiority than going out to try and shoot a duck or a goose and not managing to, because, you know, it sort of outwits you, really. So it's a completely opposite process to getting the Big Mac from McDonald's, where, you know, you truly have dominion over the cow, even what sauce you want to eat him with. You know, you can decide, but 15p extra or whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, unlike industrial livestock farming, hunting is a very natural phenomenon. I was reading, someone was talking about in Finland, where a wolf somehow got into a farm and killed like 130 lambs. I mean, nature is inherently brutal and, you know, based around.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is, but I mean, you know, there's hunting. I was having a big debate with the guy at the weekend about this, that, you know, there are lots of different, and what I enjoy is like, you know, going out and shooting rabbits or whatever, or, you know, shooting snipe or shooting geese, or shooting, you know, it's like, it's fairly small scale, whatever. I'm not so into, you know, if you go and shoot pheasants and the gamekeeper says to you, like, okay, what will happen is the pheasants are going to come around that side of the tree. And some might come from that side of the tree, but mostly it's going to be that side of the tree. Like, that's what's the point of that? Like, there are points to that, and you know, it's kind of business in the countryside, and the countryside needs money coming in and so on. But that isn't giving me the kick that I like getting from field sports or hunting or fishing or whatever it is.
It's just like slightly elevated target practice.
Exactly. I mean, no, I do write a lot about, you know, I'd like to, I'd like to move beyond hunting in my columns a little bit. There's lots of things I'd like to write about more. I'd like to write about, you know, eel trapping and thatching and so on. But, you know, time is limited, and it's always the case that in that month I've been out trying to catch something or whatever. So, you know, that's why it kind of falls down the way it does.
Just one more hunting question, and then maybe we can move on to eel trapping. You wrote a piece quite recently about saying goodbye to a favorite gun. I think if you said to the average British person, like, you had an emotional relationship with a gun, in their head they'd be visualizing the kind of American who has 50 machine guns in his warehouse and
ever since my wife died,
thieves.
Yeah, my main relationship has been with this. No, I mean, I'm not sure if I had an emotion. I feel like you're projecting onto that piece. It was a fairly. I mean, yesterday I got the note through from the auction house to say it didn't sell, which is a frustration, and that's a part of a bigger conversation on the lack of popularity at the moment in old English guns, but. But yeah, that was a gun that I had for a long time. My godfather gave me that gun. But I, you know, you constantly, I'm sure there won't be many listeners who think this same thing regularly, but you've constantly got to look at your gun cabinet and you've got to think, okay, what have we got in here? You know, what purpose does this serve? You know, do I need to change this? Do I need whatever? So unfortunately that one, at the moment I've only got one old gun in my cabinet, which is there was a reader of Shooting Times magazine, which I edit, who got in touch with me and said that his great uncle Liger, who was a prolific mid-Norfolk poacher, had left him a hammer gun from Darlow of Norwich. It was like his greatest possession, and he used to take it out on his bicycle at night when he was poaching. And would I like it? And I said, of course I would. So I went to see these guys, and they gave me this gun. So that's the only old gun that I've got in my cabinet.
I don't know much about guns, but I have friends who are very interested in guitars, and I find with them they'll be very attached to a guitar until they read about this new amazing guitar.
And then they're like,
Is there some comparisons there with gun ownership?
I'm not massively keen on. I mean, it gets unbelievably technical. So like, how many different rifle calibers you've got, what they're good for. You know, so that you might have a rifle that's good for one thing, but it would cause too much meat damage with deer. So it's very technical. I'm not massively into it. Some people, that's really what they're into. I'm really just into what you can do with them, you know, and not causing too much meat damage. That's something, because for me a lot of it's about game and cooking, which I like. So the less meat damage the better.
Yeah, so you can maximize the muntjac deer.
Exactly that.
There are so many traditions in the countryside which people who aren't connected to our rural landscapes and heritage just wouldn't know about. I mean, you mentioned eel trapping, and I know what it is, but I'm ashamed to say I don't really know what it involves. Like, I have no idea what the process is.
No, I mean, well, nor really do I, like, apart from having read stuff. But I was talking to my girlfriend's dad grew up in Gloucestershire. And there was an old guy there, an old gamekeeper there, who, funnily enough, remembers shooting with Edward Elgar, which is an extraordinary thing. And this keeper's still around. And my girlfriend's father was telling me that occasionally he went eel trapping with this guy. And like, this was down on the Severn, and the tide would come up. And they would stand there and they would shout that like a boar tide or whatever was coming up. And then they would get like the nets, you know, so just that kind of thing is remarkable. And I think actually very dangerous as well, because you're standing right there, it's dark and this tide rushes through. Who knows? And like, you know, did he go once? Did that happen? Did he read about that? And then is, you know what I mean? So like that's the whole kind of thing that I find really, really interesting. There's all these ways of living which have kind of gone or are going or whatever.
I'm hoping this question is going to land, because I'm trying to bring together various thoughts that I've just been having throughout this interview. But you were talking about how it doesn't make much sense and isn't very productive to draw a very clear distinction between, you know, city folk and rural folk. Do you think there are any kind of traditionally rural, well, traditions that city people could engage in as well? Because if we think of conservation as, you know, those are the people who are doing it, it's quite difficult to do it effectively, because we're kind of inherently marginalizing it among the people who already do it. So what is one tradition that more people could engage with and kind of revive, do you think? I hope that question made sense.
I'm trying to grab onto bits of it. I don't know. I mean, The thing is that a lot of, I don't really know. So I think tradition is like, it's quite an interesting thing. I don't know how much of it still exists or what. I don't know. I had a very interesting time the other day. I went to see a gamekeeper in the West Country and I talked to him about these various standing stones on Dartmoor. And he said, oh, a lot of that's bollocks. He said a lot of that was just like made up by kind of like literally like Londoners in the early 20th century. I don't know. I mean,
let me put this question in a more concrete way. It occurs to me. If somebody said to you, I've just been living in zone 4 and commuting into the center of London for year after year. It's been so long since I've seen more grass than is in my local children's park. I really want to kind of reconnect with nature in some way. What do you recommend me doing?
What do I recommend? Okay, so I recommend you get in touch with my friend Paul, who runs a kickboxing gym in Bedfordshire, but is also a very good deer manager, a really good deer manager, manages a lot of deer across various parts. And go out and stalk a muntjac with them or a Chinese water deer or whatever. I mean, these creatures cause a lot of ecological harm. And, getting up there at 4 a.m. or whatever, as the sun is coming up, I think, would... There's this... I wrote recently about Ted Hughes talks about being very sick. And then he's up on the hill and somebody says... Oh, do you want to come and walk up some grouse? I'll give you a gun. And he says, oh, I've not done it in ages. I don't really want to do it. And I'm like, no, come on, Ted, we'll just give you a gun, whatever. And he says, like going out with this gun and just starting to look at the landscape and thinking, oh, could there be a grouse there? Could there be a grouse there? Whatever. Is that a grouse? Oh, it's not a grouse. It's just a curlew coming back, whatever. I think that gives you this deep understanding and deep kind of love of the natural world in a and also it might be that if you went out to stalk deer, you would think it was the most horrendous, vile, violent act. And then you might rethink your relationship with like farmed meat. And I mean, I do that quite often. Like I went the other day to a Chinese near here, very good Chinese. And this pork came and I was just thinking, I have no idea where this pig. Does it have a nice life, this pig? I don't know, probably not. Is someone mean to this pig? Maybe. And whereas I know if a muntjac comes out of a rye and you shoot it and you shoot it cleanly, I had a very, very nice life. And that actually does, I love animals a lot. And to me, the idea that something has had a, I went the other day to hear a talk that a friend was giving, who's just written a book. And part of the premise of it is that, she was there and she was putting a lemon in the cavity of a chicken and it suddenly struck her that this thing had once been a feathered live creature. And and everyone was like, what? Wow, like that's an amazing revelation. And everybody who hunts like knows that. They know about the life that this creature has. And I think that gives you it teaches you to value life in a funny way.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you can appreciate that the object once had a more expanded physical form. Whereas most of us, I think it's rare, if ever, to see a pig or a cow or even a chicken. So it's easy to kind of...
Yeah, very much so. And I also think it's this funny thing whereby being vegan and being a sort of... wholesale meat eater, that's sort of so the meat eater who will just go to McDonald's, go to KFC, whatever, has decided, actually, I'm not even going to engage with the horror of that these creatures faced in whatever, and the person who's vegan says, I'm going to take this decision and then I'm not going to have to engage because I'm doing the best thing I can possibly do, right? But we all know that if you're eating a loaf of bread, right, when that field was farmed, lots of creatures will have died. Leverets will have died. A fawn might have died. All kinds of things. But you think that if you're becoming vegan, okay, you're doing the ultimate thing. You're making the ultimate ethical choice, and then you've got kind of wholesale meat eating at the other end. And I think hunting actually sits kind of in quite a complicated position, and you start to think, all right, is the way I'm leading my life right in terms of the things I'm eating, is it right or wrong? Does it cause harm? Does it whatever? So it's quite interesting.
I know debates about conservation and how to do conservation are incredibly complicated and emotive. So if I ask you too many questions about them, I think I might have to keep you here for 5 days, 6 hours and 12 minutes. So I'm going to ask you one question kind of with two parts.
Yeah.
Let's say 25 years in the future, What do you think the British countryside will look like, and how would you like it to look?
I mean, that's a hugely, hugely complicated question. And I think what I think is starting to happen is that people are looking at areas that were always quite hard to farm and are saying, actually, could we do something else here? And, you know, there are grants now, better grants, I think, really, than there've ever been, that allow farmers to say, okay, we're going to take this out of production, and we'll farm what we should be farming because it makes sense to do so, and we won't bother kind of really, really trying our absolute hardest to make something work when it's not really working. Mm. So that's what I would like to see. I suppose also what I would like to see is there's this sort of thing at the moment whereby, you know, one farmer will do something. So NEP, for example, there's a place called NEP, which is a kind of wilding project, very interesting project, and I'm sure a great project. But you'll often hear people saying, or you'll see people saying on social media, but why can't, you know, other farmers do the same thing? And you're like, well, because what's right for there is probably not right for there. And like, the truth is that we do have to eat, and therefore we do have to farm. So it's like, could we farm better? Yes. But are you always going to have places that are going to be farmed pretty hard? You probably are. And it's like, if people can come to some sort of understanding about that, you know, I had an interesting conversation the other day with a guy from the RFPB, and he was saying to me that he would like to create this kind of set of principles that everybody agrees on, no matter where they come from. And I was saying that what I would like people to agree on is that you shouldn't really take a kind of solid position on something unless you feel that you really understand it, because to do so is sort of silly, and I don't think it is useful. He sort of agreed with that. So yeah, so I think I would like a kind of rural landscape or rural sphere where there's kind of less angst and more understanding and more listening.
Not to kind of set you up for inevitably pretentious answer that I know you won't want to give, because this is a pretentious question, but do you think being connected with nature can give you more of an advantage, in the sense that the kind of the scale of it and the mystery of it doesn't lead you to these very clear and, you know, strident answers? It leads
That's a really interesting point, actually. I mean, I think you know, to kind of bring a lofty question to a kind of earthy answer. I mean, people who I really respect will always say that a great gamekeeper is a gamekeeper who spends his life learning and will never say, oh, I understand this absolutely. Or the thing you got to know about, you know, you're very, very good gamekeepers on wild bird shoots generally. There's a guy I'm thinking of called Charlie Meller, Arundel, the Remarkable Grey Partridge Project. There's a guy called Mark Fitzer, who's gamekeeper in Norfolk. They will say they're constantly learning. You know, they are literally at the top of their game. They're incredible naturalists. You know, Charlie Meller is doing things in terms of conservation which are really like in a league of their own. But you know, he's constantly learning. And if you ask him something, he won't say, oh, well, this is how it is. You know, and you'll come across lots of like sort of part-time gamekeepers who believe that they know absolutely everything. And I think it's the same in general. I mean, to really engage is to be like, shit, the magnitude of this is so great that that you couldn't possibly understand it all. And what happens one year might not be the same as what happens next year. Like, how long do you really have to kind of be somewhere to understand it? You know, I mean, yeah, I spent about 10 years on the same patch of ground in southwest Scotland, and there were things that I was discovering at the end of that decade that I didn't know about, like woodcock flight lines that were changing slightly, new, you know. So I think in life it pays to be kind of wary of the man with all the answers.
Do you think it's fair to say?
But it's normally a man. Yeah.
Do you think it's fair to say that politicians and opinion columnists could learn something from gamekeepers?
I'm just trying to think if there's anybody in Parliament who also, you know, does a bit of keeping on the side. Absolutely. Yeah. I think so. I mean, because they have to make. Yeah, I sat there in Parliament the other day when Labour were introducing a bill to do with access in the countryside, and there were people in the gallery who were very, very pro-access, who were irritated because it was clear that Labour didn't really understand what they were talking about. And there were people in the gallery who were quite anti-access, who were irritated because it was clear that Labour didn't really understand what they were talking about. They just kind of latched onto this sort of, you know, which is really, really interesting.
I've just got one more question. It's a very practical question. Anybody is interested in experiencing the countryside more, I read an article recently in the Times about killer cows.
Killer cows, okay.
Cows kind of charging people, and especially people with dogs, which was surprising to me because I did a lot of walking when I was young and I never had bad experience.
You were never killed by a cow, not once.
Here's a very practical question. If someone finds themselves in a field with some threatening looking cows, how should they behave?
The answer always, if you've got a dog, is to let the dog off the lead. It's a funny thing. Cows are very curious about dogs. And I think, I spoke to someone, I'm trying to remember if I just dreamt this, but I think I spoke to somebody about this who had a theory, and I don't know where they got it from, but that dogs are natural predators of cows in a sense. I mean, they're not, right? But like once upon a time, the great-great-great-grandfather of the cow and the great-great-great-grandfather of the dog times whatever, you know. But probably maybe something else would have killed the cow and then the dog would have come along and scat. But anyway, like, so this guy's theory was that cows look at dogs and they're like, this is interesting. There's some kind of danger here, but it's not really that like dangerous anymore. Like, what is this? What's going on here? And that's why they're curious. So, you know, the cow is not really going to go for you, but the cow might kind of, you know, mess around with your dog. But the dog is going to be very fast. I mean, I think a dog's much faster than a cow. So someone's probably going to say that's wrong, but I think that is the case. So therefore, people want to protect their dog because they have this weird relationship with their dog. But, you know, if you just let the dog go, then... and also, you know, if you've got a herd of cattle coming towards you and you give them a little, you kind of flap your arms, you make yourself big, then normally they get out of there. So
yeah, we're very blessed that animals tend not to appreciate just how physically weak most of us are. The fact
I could be killed by a squirrel, you know, this afternoon. You know, if one really went for me, I think. But hopefully that won't happen. I'd hope it would be a good obituary in place of my next column if that did happen.
Man killed by squirrel would make for an excellent obituary, but please don't go near any trees today because I don't want to tempt fate. Patrick Galbraith, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.